Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events and issues. The issue we're analyzing today is Vikings. For a society that lived about 1,000 years ago, people are still very interested in the Vikings. There's a pro football team in Minnesota named after them, and countless high schools throughout the U.S. have the Vikings as their mascot. They still make movies and TV shows about the Vikings. Why do they hold our imagination so much? I think it's because people see the Vikings as the best example of an irresistible force. These were raiders that seemingly could not be stopped. And that grabs the attention of people today. Let's start with the name. The Vikings did not call themselves Vikings. That name was given to them later on. There's a debate about where this term came from and what does that name Viking even mean. Frankly, we don't know for sure where the term Viking came from. Some people claim that the word Viking was an old Norse word meaning pirate or raider, but that's probably not true. I've read a few books about Vikings, and I've even tried to research this particular topic of the origin of their name, and I cannot find a definitive answer. It seems to me that the most plausible explanation is that the term Viking meant an activity. A person went Viking. This meant going on an expedition. An expedition could be for exploration, trading, or what they considered the most fun, a raid. At the time of the Viking Age, a lot of people just referred to them as the Norsemen, meaning the Northmen or men from the north. Before we go any further, let's get one thing straight. They did not have horns on their helmets. There's no evidence that any Vikings had horns on the side of their helmets. In the 1800s, Scandinavian artists sometimes depicted Vikings as having horns on their helmets. We're not sure why, but the myth was solidified because of helmets found in Vikså, Denmark. In 1942, two helmets were found with horns on the sides. It seems that people thought that these were Viking helmets since they were found in Denmark. But it's now widely believed that the helmets date to around 900 BCE. And Viking culture did not start until over 1600 years later. That brings up the question, when was the Viking Age? In truth, we can't list specific dates for the start or end of a certain period of history. But historians do love to assign dates, even if they're not really accurate. The fall of the western half of the Roman Empire is listed as 476 CE. That's because the last Roman emperor, at least in the western half of the Roman Empire, a minor named Romulus, was overthrown by a Germanic leader named Odoacer. But it's not real black and white. It's not like the Western Roman Empire was doing fine right up until 476 CE, and then the Middle Ages began. But we like to have specific dates when possible. That applies to the Viking era. Historians like to assign the start of the Viking Age as 793 CE and the end at 1066 CE. I'll get into that ending date of 1066 later on. Let's start with what occurred in 793 CE and why that's considered the start of the Viking period. On June 8 in the year 793 CE, the Vikings attacked a monastery located on the island of Lindisfarne. It's a little island off the northeast coast of England. It's an area called Northumberland, which borders Scotland. This is considered the first true Viking raid. It's funny how the raid on Lindisfarne is considered the beginning of the Viking Age when we know that there had actually been an attack by Vikings in Britain 4 years earlier. But that attack in 789 CE was a minor one involving a few Viking ships on the south coast of England with minor killing. But the onslaught on Lindisfarne was a true Viking raid. Think about what it must have been like for those monks. You're going about your business when all of a sudden these strange-looking people in ships with dragon heads on the front arrive on your island. Without any warning or demands, they overrun the monastery and just start slaughtering people. Besides the sheer terror of the event, I'm sure that the main thought going through the heads of most of these monks was, who the hell are these guys? Nobody had heard of Vikings before this. They weren't expecting raiders coming in from the sea and attacking what was considered a holy place of Christianity. These were strange men in strange clothes speaking a strange language. There was no reasoning with them. The monks couldn't just say, go ahead and take the valuables and leave us alone. These guys were here for pillage and slaughter. The Vikings took all of the gold, silver, and jewels they could find. They also took a lot of the monks as slaves. We have a written account of this onslaught by Simeon of Durham. He was an Anglo-Saxon historian who wrote a couple of books. Unfortunately, these were written well over two centuries after the raid on Lindisfarne. But I love his description of this attack. They miserably ravaged and pillaged everything. They trod the holy things under their polluted feet. They dug down the altars and plundered all the treasures of the church. Some of the brethren they slew, some they carried off with them in chains. The greater number they stripped naked, insulted, and cast out of doors, and some they drowned in the sea. News of the attack on Lindisfarne spread across Europe, creating fear of these marauders from Scandinavia. The people of Europe were right to be scared. The Vikings were just getting started. So where did these people come from? The short answer is Scandinavia. The Vikings came from the area that is now known as the countries of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. Those countries did not exist at the time. There were no organized nation states yet in Scandinavia. So let's set the scene for Europe in the late 700s CE. These were medieval times. Although the Western Roman Empire had fallen, the Eastern Roman Empire remained with their capital of Constantinople. That city is now known as Istanbul. Although the people of Constantinople and their empire considered themselves as Romans, history knows them as the Byzantine Empire. That empire lasted until the Ottomans finally captured Constantinople on May 29, 1453. I'll discuss the Vikings' interaction with Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire later on. But throughout the Viking era, Western Europe was in the middle of the Dark Ages. For some reason, it's now considered bad to use that term Dark Ages. You're only supposed to refer to that time between the fall of the Western Roman Empire and the Italian Renaissance as the Middle Ages. That's ridiculous. It's an accurate description. I feel very sorry for people who lived during the Dark Ages. Those centuries were terrible. People's lives were horrible. Most people lived in squalor and ignorance. The literacy rate in Western Europe in the Dark Ages was well below 20%. Life expectancy was much shorter because of all of the diseases. Even before the Black Death came to Europe in 1347, Europeans were dying in droves from common diseases, including influenza, dysentery, measles, and even leprosy. One of the problems in examining the history of the Vikings is the scarcity of written records. The Vikings themselves did not leave any written histories, at least not history in the way we think of history, written in a long descriptive format. So most of the information we have about the Vikings is from the peoples that the Vikings attacked. The Vikings were not illiterate. They did write certain things down on stone, wood, and metal. This writing was done with enigmatic symbols known as runes, that's spelled R-U-N-E-S. Each rune represents a phonetic sound and also has its own meaning, usually connected with Norse mythology. But the Viking writings in runes tend to be short and usually describing a particular person. The information about large events was passed down in Viking sagas. These were oral traditions that were passed down through the generations. Viking sagas were first written by people in Iceland in the late 1200s. This was after the end of the Viking Age. The Vikings were seafaring, and there's a good reason for this. There were not many roads in Scandinavia, mostly because of the geography. On the Scandinavian Peninsula, which includes modern-day Sweden and Norway, there are a lot of mountains, and a lot of Scandinavia has dense forests, so it was hard to get around on land. And lastly, there was water seemingly everywhere. The modern country of Denmark consists of the Jutland Peninsula, and I know that's not how the Danes pronounce it, but that's the way we say it in English, like the Battle of Jutland in World War I. Anyway, Denmark consists of the Jutland Peninsula and a lot of islands. As a matter of fact, the capital city of Copenhagen is located on the islands of Zealand and Amager. And no, that's not where the name New Zealand comes from. It wasn't the Danes, but the Dutch who named New Zealand. New Zealand got its name after the province of Zeeland in the Netherlands. Anyway, getting back to the fact that water is everywhere in Scandinavia, much of it is the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, and the Norwegian Sea. The whole coast of Norway is dotted with islands and fjords. That's a term you always hear, at least when talking about Norway. What exactly is a fjord? According to Merriam-Webster, it's a narrow inlet of the sea between cliffs or steep slopes. Scandinavia has water just about everywhere. Fun fact, Sweden has more islands than any country in the world. That surprised me when I first read that when my family and I were planning a trip to Scandinavia this past year. I would have guessed Indonesia had the most islands since it's an enormous country that is comprised only of islands. But according to the website worldatlas.com, Sweden has the most islands in the world with 221,800. The majority of those islands are uninhabited. The capital of Stockholm is built across 14 islands with 57 bridges and is absolutely beautiful. The point of all this is you can see how the Vikings got very good at traveling by water. This leads us to their most important advantage, their ships. You've seen the Viking longships on TV and in movies. They were long, fairly narrow, open boats with a big curved piece of wood at each end. That curved wood at the front of the boat was often carved into the head of a dragon. The Viking longships were the best in the world at that time for several reasons. Number one, they were incredibly strong. Number two, these boats were very light. Number three, they were fast and maneuverable. Number four, Viking longships had a very shallow draft. And number five, they could be rowed in either direction. Let's discuss each of these benefits of the Viking longships. Advantage number one, they were incredibly strong. What made the Viking ships so strong was because of the manner of their construction. They started with a strong keel, usually made out of one tree. Then they added planks. Most non-Viking boats at that time had the edges of each plank come together. Each plank butted against the next plank. They did not overlap. When you looked at the sides of those non-Viking boats, they were smooth, but not the Viking longships. The Vikings used a method called the lapstrake technique. This style of construction is also called clinker built. This meant that the planks overlapped each other. I know this is confusing without any visual aids, but picture a standard shingle roof on a house. Starting from the top of the roof, each shingle overlaps the next shingle further down the roof. That's the way the planks were on the sides and bottoms of Viking longships, and they were connected to each other with wooden or iron nails. This clinker-built construction made the Viking ships very strong. Something else that added to the strength of the Viking longships was the fact that the Vikings did not use saws. They only used axes to cut and shape the wood. The use of axes instead of saws maintained the grain and fibers in the wood, making them stronger. Reason number two, the longships were superior. They were very light for their size. The overlapping of the planks added a lot of strength to the hull. The strength of the boat was the outer shell of wood. They did not need internal beams to give stability to the boat. Other boats of that time had heavy beams going across the interior of the boat from side to side to give it strength and stability. But on the Viking longships, the hull was strong enough on its own, so they did not need those heavy interior beams. And the overlapped planking allowed the Vikings to use slender planks of wood. This also cut down on the weight of their boats. Since they did not have internal beams and had thinner planks, the ships were much lighter. This made them easier to carry at a portage. That meant carrying the boat between two navigable rivers or bodies of water. Since they could carry their boats fairly easily, the Vikings could go much further inland than most attackers could with boats. Despite being relatively light, the longships were very stable in the open ocean. The protruding laps of planks at the bow, meaning the front of the ship, acted like shock absorbers and turned the force of breaking waves to the sides of the ship. This made the boat more stable. Advantage number three, they were fast and maneuverable. As I just explained in item number two, the Viking longships were lighter. The lightweight and curved design made the Viking longships very fast. Besides their speed, the Viking longships were more maneuverable than any ships at that time. The boats were powered in two ways, by wind and by rowing. There were holes in the sides to allow the use of oars, but they only rowed when they had to. When possible, the Vikings traveled by sail, but if there was not enough wind or they needed to be more maneuverable, especially in battle, they would use oars. Rowing with oars in such light boats meant that they could turn very quickly, and this was important in battle. Technological advantage number four. The Viking longships had a very shallow draft. The draft is the distance between the waterline and the deepest part of the boat. Some of these Viking longships had a draft as little as 20 inches or 50 centimeters. That is incredibly shallow. The fact that Viking longships had such a shallow draft meant that they could go up rivers that were not very deep. Inland cities like Paris that thought that they were safe because attacking ships could not reach them learned that the Viking longships could travel up the Seine River. Design edge number five, they could be rowed in either direction. Since the longships came to a point at both ends, in an emergency, the Vikings could simply start rowing in the other direction. They did not have to turn the longship completely around like other boats had to do. If a battle was going badly or there was some other situation which required an immediate retreat, they could simply start rowing the other way. How do we know so much about Viking longships? In the late 1950s, five Viking longships were discovered by archaeologists in the waters of Denmark. The ships were not a standard size. The boats that were used for cargo were wider than the ships used for warfare, and the lengths were not standardized either. It's believed that most Viking longships carried between 24 and 50 Vikings. When you look at ships from the Middle Ages, you see lots of sails, not on Viking ships. There would only be one sail. These were large square sails on one mast in the middle of the ship. The boats were steered from the rear. They called the rudder the steerboard. If you were on the boat and looking towards the front, the rudder, or steerboard, was on the right side of a Viking longship. It's because then, as now, most people were right-handed. That's where we get the term starboard for the right side of a ship when you were facing forward, because the steerboard was located on that side of the ship. And we get the term port because if a ship was coming up to a dock, they would not want to damage the steerboard, so they would make sure it was the left side of the boat which would come alongside of the dock or the port. That's why when you face forward, the right side of a ship is called starboard and the left side of a ship is called port. To be clear, these terms did not come from the Vikings. That was just the common placement of the steering rudder for ships in the Middle Ages. And though starboard and port were not Viking terms, I just thought it was interesting to throw in. One last thing about Viking longships. They were intimidating. The dragon heads on the front made a statement, and the Vikings would hang their round shields on the sides of their longships. Besides looking cool, this let everybody know that these guys were armed and ready for battle. All right, I just described why the Viking longships were so formidable. What was it like to ride on one of those boats? The short answer is you had to be very tough. There were no creature comforts. The hardest part is that there were no indoors. There was no interior part of the longship designed for people. The Vikings would put all of their food and other necessary items in the bottom of the boat. Then they would put planks over top. The Vikings stood on those planks. But the Vikings themselves were exposed to the elements. In harsh weather, they would put up a tent-like covering. There's some controversy as to whether or not they actually used tents on board the ships, but they probably did. Think about this. You're crossing the Baltic Sea or the North Atlantic in a storm, and the only thing protecting you was a cloth tent. The Vikings used flax and wool to make sails. Presumably, those were the materials used to make the tents that covered them in bad weather. Just as important as having these incredible boats, how did the Vikings navigate in the open seas? In modern times, we measure any spot on the earth by longitude and latitude. Let's start with latitude because it's easier. Latitude is represented by those east-west lines that you see on a map or globe. They are parallel to each other. Latitude is an angle which ranges from 0 degrees at the equator to 90 degrees at the North Pole and 90 degrees at the South Pole. So So when we designate latitude, we say 40 degrees north, meaning 40 degrees north of the equator. In the northern hemisphere, you can measure the altitude of Polaris, also known as the North Star. The northern hemisphere is incredibly lucky that Polaris is essentially located directly above the North Pole. Unfortunately, there's no equivalent in the southern hemisphere. Sailors could locate their latitude in the northern hemisphere by measuring the angle of Polaris above the horizon. The further north you are, the higher the angle of Polaris. So if you were at the North Pole, it's directly overhead, which is 90 degrees. If a navigator on a ship measured the angle of Polaris and found that it was 40 degrees from the horizon, then the ship was located at 40 degrees north of the equator. It was more difficult to do in the southern hemisphere or during the day because Polaris, the North Star, was not visible. What about longitude? Longitude fixes the location of a place on Earth east or west of a north-south line called the prime meridian. That's a man-made line. International conventions set the prime meridian at Greenwich, England. So longitude is given at an angular measurement that ranges from 0 degrees at the prime meridian to 180 degrees eastward or 180 degrees westward of the prime meridian. Sailors were not able to accurately measure longitude until the mid-1700s when an Englishman named John Harrison built a practical clock which could be utilized on ships. It's too long to go into that here, but if you're interested, I did an episode called Time Zones, which explains this all in great detail. How did the Vikings determine their position when sailing? They didn't have this equipment. Of course, navigation was much easier when they were in sight of land. They would look for particular landmarks to figure out where they were. The hard part was when they were in the open seas and could not see land in any direction. Let's be clear. The Vikings did not use terms latitude or longitude or any other words meaning latitude and longitude. But the Vikings did generally figure out what we call latitude by how high the North Star was at night. The higher that Polaris was in the sky, the further north they were. The lower the North Star was towards the horizon, the further south they were. They did not have tools to measure the angle of the North Star above the horizon. They merely used their eyes and did rough estimates. They did the same with the sun during the day, but in the opposite manner. When they determined that the sun was at its highest point, meaning noon, they had an approximation as to how far north they were. The sun is higher in the sky the farther south they were, and lower in the sky the farther north they were. Of course, they had to take into account the different seasons. Obviously, these were all just approximations, but the Vikings used these observations of the North Star and the sun to give them an estimate of their latitude. Their main skill was to try to keep on a steady course. They did not have compasses. We take compasses for granted, but they were truly an amazing innovation. Having a handheld device, which has a magnetic needle pointer, which will point towards the North Pole, or for those of you south of the equator, the South Pole, is great for navigation. Sailors on an open sea can use a compass to make sure that they stay on a direct course. We don't know when magnetic compasses first were discovered. We do know that the ancient Greeks understood magnetism. Historians think that the Chinese may have developed the first magnetic compasses around the 11th century or 12th century. It appears that the magnetic compass reached Western Europe and went into use in the 1100s CE. This was after the Viking era. So, without the use of magnetic compasses, how did the Vikings navigate when they could not see land? They mainly determined direction by using the North Star at night. And during the day, they just relied on the position of the sun. Early in the morning, the sun was in the east. Late in the day, the sun was in the west. And in the middle of the day, what we consider noon, the sun would be in the south. This was not precise, but it was the best that they could do. So they mainly navigated by heading in a particular direction, north or west or southwest, etc., and staying on a course in that direction. They had no way of measuring what we call longitude. Since they could not determine at what longitude they were, they did their estimates for east and west based upon the anticipated length of a voyage. They generally had a rough idea of how long it would take to go from point A to point B and just hoped that they were going to get to their destination in the estimated number of days. Example, they knew it was so many days between Ireland and Iceland. If they went past that number of days, then they figured that they were too far west and that they had missed Iceland. What about cloudy days? Sometimes it's so overcast you can't see the sun at all. There's a current theory that the Vikings used crystals called sunstones. These crystals polarized light to allow the Vikings to determine the direction of the sun. Overall, the Vikings had incredible navigational skills. I think it would be hard to find modern-day sailors who would be willing to cross the North Atlantic without any navigational tools other than their own eyes and experience. What were their primary weapons? Mainly, the Vikings used battle axes. Some Vikings did have swords, but that was the minority. A sword is good for battle, but not for everyday use. Axes are good for battle, but can also be used in chopping down trees or building ships. So just about every Viking had an axe. Very few of them could also afford to have a sword as well. Vikings also used spears. A spear was a lot cheaper and easier to make than a sword. There's not much metal on a spear. There's just a metal tip at the end of the wooden shaft. The Vikings were also very good archers. Bows and arrows were good for long-distance fighting. And all Vikings carried a shield. The shields were round and brightly colored. The shields were made of planks of wood. In the middle of the shield was a dome of iron to protect the hand of the person holding that shield. This was called a boss. Okay, I've now described their incredible boats and their weapons. Now it's time to talk about the thing the Vikings are most famous for, raiding. At the beginning of this episode, I described the first big raid on Lindisfarne in Britain. The Vikings sacked towns and cities throughout most of Europe. The Vikings attacked Paris at least twice. The first big Viking attack on Paris occurred in the spring of 845 CE. The Vikings easily defeated the army sent to stop them as they proceeded up the Seine River. After a short siege, the Vikings plundered Paris. The second big Viking attack on Paris was 40 years later, in the year 885 CE. When the Vikings returned in 885 CE, they found a fortified city. We don't know how large this Viking army was. I've read different estimates. One estimate is that there were approximately 300 longships, which carried somewhere over 10,000 men. Paris is not a coastal town. Paris is roughly 100 miles or 160 kilometers inland from the English Channel. Of course, it's much farther than that if you're taking the route that the Vikings took, which meant sailing up the Seine River from the English Channel up to the city of Paris. The Vikings had been making raids in the Carolingian Empire, which was essentially the area of modern-day France plus parts of Germany, Italy, and Switzerland for years. But this was the biggest Viking invasion in that region. If you go to modern-day Paris, you will see that the city is on both banks of the Seine River. But in the 800s CE, the city was essentially confined to the Île de la Cité. That's an island in the middle of the Seine River. Today, that island is in the center of Paris, and it's where the Cathedral of Notre Dame is located. The Vikings arrived at Paris in November 885. When the Vikings arrived, they found that strong walls surrounded Paris on the Île de la Cité. There were two bridges from the Île de la Cité, one to each bank of the Seine River. The bridges were somewhat fortified. Normally, the Vikings would not do a siege. They liked to do raids. They would storm the city, steal everything they wanted, kill anybody in their way, and then leave with their plunder. But since Paris was a walled city, the Vikings had to conduct a siege. A siege is a military operation in which the attackers surround a town or structure and cut off essential supplies like food to eventually compel the surrender of the people inside the town or fortified structure. The Vikings did not conduct sieges very often because it was easier to just move on to a weaker target. The siege of Paris lasted for approximately 1 year. Finally, in October 886, the king of West Francia, known as Charles the Fat, came to Paris with his army and negotiated a resolution with the Vikings. What'd he do? He paid them off with silver. The Vikings took the silver and left. Now let's talk about a different part of modern-day France, Normandy. If you mention Normandy to a group of Americans, most of them will immediately think of the same thing, D-Day. Normandy was the location of the Allied invasion of Nazi-occupied mainland Europe on June 6, 1944. The invasion troops were mainly from the US, the UK, and Canada. Everybody remembers the British and the Americans, but for some reason, the Canadians often get forgotten. They should not be overlooked for their contributions on D-Day. Getting back to Normandy, there's a lot of history in Normandy besides the D-Day invasion. The name Normandy comes from the Northmen. In the Middle Ages, when people talked about the Northmen or Norsemen, they were referring to the Vikings. In the early 900s CE, another king of West Francia, this one known as Charles the Simple, decided that the easiest way to rid himself and his kingdom of the Viking menace was to buy them off in a permanent manner. So Charles the Simple made a deal with a Viking leader named Rollo. The Vikings were given a large section of land on what's now the northwest coast of France along the English Channel. This land is now known as Normandy because of the Norsemen. Rollo and his Norsemen got to keep the land on two conditions. Number one, they would stop raiding any other parts of West Francia. Number two, they would protect West Francia from other Viking invaders. The Vikings did not always raid other people's towns and then leave. They actually formed some settlements of their own. Their most successful example is Iceland. The Vikings founded Iceland. There's some dispute among historians as to whether or not Irish monks had reached Iceland before the Vikings. We don't know for sure. It's believed that the Vikings first came to Iceland in 861 CE. And whether or not they were first, the Vikings were the people who established permanent settlements. This was in the 870s CE. The oldest known settlement in Iceland is believed to have been started in 874 CE. The Viking settlements flourished and more Scandinavians poured in. They eventually created what has become the modern country of Iceland. The Vikings were the ones who named this new land Iceland. By the way, capital city of Iceland, Reykjavik, is the northernmost capital city in the world. And now, of course, you're dying to know what's the southernmost capital, and that would be Wellington, New Zealand. In the 980 CE, a Viking explorer named Eric the Red left Iceland. He didn't leave of his own accord. Eric the Red was exiled from Iceland because he had killed somebody. I know what you're thinking. The Vikings killed lots of people. It was okay to murder people when they were your enemy, but you couldn't kill people from your own community. So Eric the Red sailed off to the west of Iceland and discovered the largest island in the world. He named this enormous island Greenland. Apparently, Eric the Red understood marketing and realized that if he named the place Greenland, it was more likely that he could convince people to move there. The Vikings established two communities in the southern part of Greenland, known as the Eastern Settlement and the Western Settlement. Those two Viking communities lasted from somewhere around the 980s CE to the 1400s. These were small settlements, and we think that the Viking population in Greenland never exceeded 2,500 people. Europeans did not return to Greenland until the early 1700s. They discovered ruins of Viking settlements. For years, there had been questions as to why the Vikings abandoned Greenland. I always assumed that at some point they realized there had to be someplace else that was much easier to live in than Greenland. Practically any place in the world would be easier to live in. But recent studies assert that there was a severe rise in the sea level and that some settlements experienced over 10 feet or over 3 meters of sea level rise during the time that the Vikings lived in Greenland. There were not a lot of areas that were habitable in Greenland. The rise in the sea level flooded most of those areas. Who were the first Europeans to come to the Americas? It used to be, people would say, Christopher Columbus in 1492. I'm not saying he discovered the Americas because there were already millions of people living in the Western Hemisphere when Columbus arrived. I'm talking about Europeans first coming to the Americas. It was long believed that the Vikings had arrived in what's now Canada around the year 1000 CE. It was believed that a man named Leif Erikson, the son of Eric the Red, led the first group of Vikings to North America. He named this new place Vinland. But until 1960, there was no proof of this. In 1960, archaeologists uncovered a Viking settlement in an area that's now called Lons-o-Meadows. At least 8 separate buildings were discovered. This is in the Canadian province of Newfoundland. From what we know, Leif Erikson and the Vikings only stayed in North America for a few years. We believe that the Vikings left because they were outnumbered by the indigenous peoples in that area, who were not happy about the invaders. It was always an estimate that the Vikings arrived in Newfoundland around the year 1000, but a new study pinpoints the exact year that Leif Erikson arrived in the Americas, 1021. How could they possibly determine a specific year? Well, in 2021, some scientists examined 4 pieces of wood that had been discovered at the Viking settlement in Newfoundland, now known as Lons-o-Meadows. The significance of those pieces of wood is that each had at least 1 clean edge. This meant that they had been cut by a metal tool. We know that these pieces of wood had been cut by the Vikings because the indigenous peoples did not have metal tools at that time. Through radiocarbon dating and some other scientific processes that I do not understand, the scientists were able to determine that the year was 1021. I think it's incredibly cool that the scientists made this determination in the year 2021, that the Vikings had been there exactly 1,000 years earlier in the year 1021. The fact that the Vikings explored and raided islands like Ireland, Great Britain, Iceland, Greenland, and Newfoundland probably does not surprise you. After all, these were seafaring raiders. But it may surprise you to know that the Vikings explored inland areas of what's now Russia and Ukraine. These were Vikings from the part of Scandinavia, which is now the country of Sweden. These Vikings were known as the Rus, that's spelled R-U-S. They explored and settled along the rivers between the Baltic Sea and the Black Sea. They eventually assimilated with the local peoples. This mixture of the Rus, the Vikings, with the local peoples eventually developed into a sense of nationalism and the creation of an actual Russian state and the Ukrainian state. And this is where we get the name for Russia from the Rus people. When you think of the Vikings, you picture these guys covered in heavy furs because they came from Scandinavia and they were traveling through frigid waters like the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and the Norwegian Sea. But the Vikings went all the way down to warm climates like Spain and parts of North Africa. They entered the Mediterranean and conquered Sicily. The Vikings even reached Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, and is located in the modern country of Turkey. As I explained earlier, Constantinople was the capital of the Byzantine Empire, which was the successor to the Eastern Roman Empire. This was easily the largest city in Europe at that time, and it was also the wealthiest. Constantinople was a heavily fortified city, and the Vikings were not able to breach its walls. But although they could not conquer Constantinople, a lot of Vikings ended up living there. Basil II, an emperor of the Byzantine Empire, hired Vikings as his personal bodyguard. They were known as the Varangians. Byzantine emperors continued using Vikings as their personal bodyguards. This was a brilliant move by the Byzantine emperors. You take these incredibly fierce warriors that had been trying to sack your city and instead pay them off to be your personal bodyguards. Earlier I told you that the Viking Age is generally considered to have started with the sacking of the monastery at Lindisfarne in the year 793 CE. The year that's considered to mark the end of the Viking Age is 1066. If you study history, you often hear that year, 1066. It was the last time that Britain was invaded. The English Channel stopped Napoleon and Hitler, but not the Vikings. 2 big battles occurred in 1066 in England. The first was the Battle of Stamford Bridge on September 25, 1066. A large Viking army under King Harald Hardrada invaded England from Norway. They were soundly defeated at the Battle of Stamford Bridge by Anglo-Saxon forces under King Harold Godwinson, also known as King Harold II. Viking King Harald Hardrada was killed in the battle. But the English king did not get to enjoy his victory for very long. 3 weeks later, on October 14, 1066, the Anglo-Saxon army of King Harald Godwinson was defeated at the Battle of Hastings. Harald Godwinson was the last Anglo-Saxon king of England. The victorious army was led by William the Conqueror of Normandy. This was the Norman conquest. Earlier I told you about the region of Normandy in the northwest part of modern-day France. It had been settled by Vikings who, over a century, mingled with the local peoples. But these were still Viking descendants who were incredibly fierce. After the victory at the Battle of Hastings and some other minor skirmishes, William the Conqueror was crowned King of England on Christmas Day, 1066. This was the last successful conquest of England. This forever changed England politically, economically, and socially. Of course, all of this exploration, plundering, and founding of settlements over such an enormous area raises the question as to why this all started. What caused the Vikings to leave Scandinavia and conquer so many areas far from home? We're not exactly sure. There are some different theories, but the most prevalent one seems to be that there was a lot of population growth in Scandinavia. This meant that there was less available land for agriculture, and this caused young men to take to the seas to seek their fame and fortune. Other theories include a shortage of available female partners in Scandinavia. In the late 1970s, China imposed the one-child policy. They were trying to curb their enormous population by limiting couples to only one child. Most parents in communist China preferred having sons because they thought that they were more productive and could care for the parents when they grew old. This resulted in the horrific situation in China where baby girls were abandoned after birth or outright killed simply because they were female. The one-child policy in China ended in 2015. The reason I bring up that situation in China is because some historians have theorized that a similar situation occurred in Scandinavia before the Viking Age. The theory is that a lot of people in Scandinavia were killing or discarding babies when they discovered that they were girls. Anyway, the theory is that because of the killing off of a lot of baby girls, there were not enough women to partner up with all of the young men in Scandinavia. So these young guys went out in their longships to better their lot in life. To be clear, this is just a theory. Another theory that there might have been less available women was because older and more powerful men had multiple wives. And this is why young guys went raiding, looking for women in other places. These are just theories. The short answer is, we don't know for sure why these fearsome people from Scandinavia burst out of the north and dominated Europe and beyond for centuries. Now let's look at the other question. Why did the Vikings stop raiding and conquering? Why did they stop pouring out of Scandinavia and terrorizing Europe and beyond? Not all historians agree. But the explanations that seem most plausible to me are the following. Number one, Christianity started taking hold in Scandinavia. Don't get me wrong, Christian societies have been invading and killing each other for the last 2,000 years. But the difference is that Christian leaders were doing it contrary to their religious beliefs. The Viking pagan religions encouraged conquest and slaughter. The Norse gods like Odin and Thor looked favorably upon warfare. The Vikings believed that dying in battle would send them to Valhalla, the great hall in Norse mythology where heroes slain in battle were received. So things are a little different if you believe in a religion that rewards you for being a brave warrior and dying in battle, as compared to Christianity telling you that the meek shall inherit the earth. You still might go killing and pillaging, but your conscience might be bothering you. Number two, another theory why the Vikings stopped raiding and conquering was because it was no longer so easy. It's not that the Vikings grew soft. They were still the toughest people around. It's just that it was no longer so easy to raid other peoples because of better defenses. Coastal communities, especially in Europe, gradually transformed into more centralized states. These bigger states could field larger armies to fight off the Vikings. Also, these more centralized governments could raise more money to build fortifications. The Vikings did not bring siege equipment with them. They could make siege equipment, like when they were attacking Paris in 885 to 886 CE, but that really was not their usual manner of operating. They liked lightning-quick attacks. Slaughter people in hand-to-hand combat. Grab all of the valuables you can. Take away people as slaves, and then leave. If the Vikings were forced to stay around for a while, there was a possibility some larger army might come to the rescue of the local population. So as walled towns and fortifications, like castles, became more common, it made it much harder to do the kind of rapid assaults that the Vikings considered their specialty. What happened to Viking culture? The Vikings that settled in other lands assimilated. And by that, I don't mean they disappeared. The Vikings merged into the local populations and created new societies. The Rus merged with the local peoples and became the modern Russians and Ukrainians. The Vikings in the northwest part of France became the Normans. The Normans eventually spoke French, but their society was different than what was existing in West Francia before the Vikings got there. Probably the most famous example is what happened in England. After the Norman conquest of 1066 and the changes instituted by William the Conqueror, land was redistributed, often in return for military service. This led to a new type of feudalism which dominated England for centuries. But there were some places that the Vikings did not merge with local peoples. An easy example is Iceland. There was probably nobody there when the Vikings arrived, but the people on that island evolved over the centuries into the modern country of Iceland. What about Scandinavia? Over the years, these small, decentralized communities eventually evolved into the kingdoms which became Denmark, Sweden, and Norway today. That's it for today. Please subscribe to this podcast. Please like this and my other episodes. Reviews really help. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, it's easy to do. Scroll down the History Analyzed show page, select a rating, hopefully 5 stars, and then tap Write a Review. If you're listening on Spotify or any other podcast apps which allow ratings, I would greatly appreciate a 5-star rating. Please tell your friends, relatives, and coworkers. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the audience for History Analyzed. Check out my website, historyanalyzed.com, where you will find links to fun items for all history geeks. Thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.